Hello, everyone. You are listening to another episode of the Sunstone Fireside Podcast, and I am your host, Blair Osler. Today, I'm really excited to introduce you to my guest. I consider her a friend, a mentor, a professor, and she's wicked smart when it comes to gender studies and philosophy. And today, we're going to have a conversation about gender, and we're going to be talking about the recent changes in the LDS handbook concerning transgender persons. But before we get too into that, I want to take some time to have Kelly Potter introduce all her magnificent self and all her accomplishments at being a super awesome philosopher, pretty much. Kelly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So could you give us a little bit of background about yourself? I know your background is in analytic philosophy and specifically logic. And just so everybody knows, Kelly taught me everything I know about logic. And I tell you, it's not for the faint of heart. So if you can learn logic, that's one thing. And if you can teach logic, that's quite another thing.
Yeah. So I went to undergrad at BYU in philosophy, and then I went out to Florida State and also Notre Dame to study philosophy focusing on logic. But I was always interested as well in the philosophy of religion. So when I ended up getting hired at UVU, I became the Mormon Studies coordinator there and kind of did a lot of work in Mormon studies and in the philosophy of religion more generally. And I still love teaching logic, and I read about it and keep up on it, but my research is all focused on philosophy of religion and philosophy of gender now.
I love that. I love that. It's so desperately needed too. And I know you have a couple papers either published or being published, and could you tell me a little bit about those?
Oh yeah. So, I have a paper, entitled Transfeminist Critique of Mormon Theologies of Gender, which is coming out in, came out in a book called The Lost Sheep, Disability, Race, Gender, and Animals, The Lost Sheep, New Perspectives on Disability, Race, Gender, and Animals. And in that paper, I look both at what I take to be the orthodox theology of Mormonism on gender, and also feminist theology or Mormon feminist theology of gender as well. So Margaret Toscano and Janice Allredon. And I critique both of those perspectives are from a trans perspective, pointing out that, for example, the wording of the Proclamation on the Family is actually consistent with with the way that some trans folk describe their experience.
Yeah.
In fact, the idea that both the spirit and the body are gendered sort of begs for a mismatch sometimes, right?
Right.
So anyway, I argue in there that it's pretty clear that the Church hasn't done their research. When they wrote the Proclamation of the Family, they hadn't done their research on trans folk, and the policies weren't grounded in any theology. And I even argued that the Proclamation itself was never really well grounded in earlier Mormon theology, because Proclamation was one of the things that made me leave Mormonism. So anyway, that's one paper. I won't go further.
I talked
about too many details, maybe.
No, that's perfect. Well, and I love that you brought up the idea of, as someone also who has studied gender herself, that for me, I notice so many times when the church says something on gender or comes out with a new policy or proclamation, I just want to say, hey, you need to involve someone who's actually studied this, because a lot of your positions just aren't making a lot of sense and or are not accomplishing even the goals you wanted to accomplish in the first place. And so I'm really glad you brought that up. Fascinating. So let's go a little bit more with your background. You're trans. And how has that transition been for you being a professor here in Utah Valley?
Well, my transition actually has been, for the most part, very positive.
Mm-hmm.
People who are close to me in my life have all accepted me, including my family.
Which is huge.
Yeah, with the exception of one of my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, I feel very supported, and I have good therapy and so on. So I've got really good support in transitioning. The school has also been very good. Utah Valley University has been pretty good. I mean, they're not, I don't want to say very good because they don't pay for all the medical care that's necessary for trans folk, but they do pay for some of it. So
that's something.
Yeah,
that's something.
So in those ways, it's been positive. But I came out basically right after Trump was elected, and that was when I started HRT, hormone replacement therapy.
Right.
And that's also when a sort of backlash against trans folks sort of got a lot of steam. And so at the same time that trans individuals in this society are being more accepted, especially by like the medical clinical establishment, there's also a backlash of, you know, conservative and also radical feminist voices that are very critical. And that happens to have occurred also in the academic discipline of philosophy. And there's almost a big rift in philosophy about this issue now. And so I, you know, as an out trans woman, I've been upset by all of that, by all that backlash.
Well, and do you find also in some ways, because philosophy is very androcentric, it's very white, it's very male. And I've found that even in studying philosophy, it's almost like digging into the roots of the systems of oppression that are almost against you in a lot of ways, like, because there's not a lot of queer people in philosophy and hardly any queer philosophers, at least like historically. More are emerging, but like historically, like, it's hard to come across philosophical texts that are like geared towards a trans experience or even a non-binary experience or recognizing the ambiguities that exist between these things. Philosophy for me is a love-hate relationship because it's like I can't stop reading it and things like that. But at the same time, I'm just kind of like, oh, this is how we got to now. This is why we're here. This is why we have the attitudes we have concerning gender and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So, I took a philosophy class from Kelly, and it was philosophy of gender, and it was hands down by far, don't tell the other philosophy professors this, my favorite class I took at UVU. It's a close second to Mike Shaw's Foucault class. That was a really awesome class. And I think Jonathan Toombs, he was a professor of that class too. And that was a really great class. But the philosophy of gender class was fantastic because one of the problems we have when we talk about gender is that we're talking about it in a very binary sense. And then we talk about it as if it's not taken critically as opposed to all these assumptions that are at the table. And we just take them and say, boys are like this and girls are like this. But even when you take other gender classes too, in the field of gender studies, we don't get enough into the trans experience. So sometimes when people talk about the idea of gender equality, I want to like be like, which kind of gender equality are you talking about? Gender equality for cis women? Gender equality for trans people? Are you including the non-binary fluid experience? What are you talking about? And so taking Kelly's class, it was amazing. We got to dive into all sorts of the nitty-gritty details of gender that most gender conversations being had aren't going into these details. And so when we talk about these policy changes and when we're talking about transgender issues, just keeping in mind that this is a much bigger conversation than the typical gender equality conversation happening. Let's go ahead and dive into the handbook and the new changes. For people who have not read these yet, I'll go ahead and read it. And then Kelly and I are going to take a closer look at what's actually being said in here. So for the audience, I will start at section 38.6.21, entitled Transgender Individuals. And it goes like this, quote, "Transgender individuals face complex challenges. Members and non-members who identify as transgender and their family and friends should be treated with sensitivity, kindness, compassion, and an abundance of Christ-like love. We are all welcome to attend sacrament meeting, other Sunday meetings, and social events of the church. Gender is an essential characteristic of Heavenly Father's plan of happiness. The intended meaning of gender in the family proclamation is biological sex at birth. Some people experience feelings of incongruence between their biological sex and their gender identity. As a result, they may identify as transgender. The church does not take a position on the cause of people identifying themselves as transgender. Most church participation and some priesthood ordinances are gender neutral. Transgender persons may be baptized and confirmed as outlined under section 38.2.3.14. They may also partake of the sacrament and receive priesthood blessings. However, priesthood ordination and temple ordinances are received according to birth sex. Church leaders counsel against elective medical or surgical interventions for the purpose of attempting to transition to the opposite gender of a person's birth sex. In parentheses, sex reassignment. Leaders have advised that taking these actions will be cause for church membership restrictions. Leaders also counsel against social transitioning. A social transition includes changing dress or grooming, or changing names or pronouns to present oneself as other than his or her birth sex. Leaders advise that those who socially transition will experience some church membership restrictions for the duration of this transition. Restrictions include receiving or exercising the priesthood, receiving or using a temple recommend, and receiving some church callings. Although some privileges of church membership are restricted, other church participation is welcome. Transgender individuals who do not pursue medical, surgical, or social transition to the opposite gender are worthy and may receive church callings, temple recommends, and temple ordinances. Some children, youth, and adults are prescribed hormone therapy by a licensed medical professional to ease gender dysphoria or reduce suicidal thoughts. Before a person begins such therapy, it is important that he or she and the parents of a minor understands the potential risks and benefits if these members are not attempting to transition to the opposite gender and are worthy, they may receive church callings, temple recommends, and temple ordinances. If a member decides to change his or her preferred name or pronouns of address, the name preference may be noted in the preferred name field on the membership record. The person may be addressed by the preferred name in the ward. Circumstances vary greatly from unit to unit and person to person. Members and leaders counsel together and with the Lord. Area presidencies will help local leaders sensitively address individual situations. Bishops counsel with the stake president. Stake presidents and mission presidents must seek counsel from the area presidency. For further information on understanding and supporting transgender individuals, see transgender on churchofjesuschrist.org. Whew, that was a mouthful, but we got through it. We have a ton to dive into here. First of all, what is your first take? They come out of the gates talking about gender being an essential characteristic of Heavenly Father's plan of happiness. And in the second sentence say, intended meaning of gender, the family proclamation is biological sex at birth. What are your thoughts?
That strikes me as a really weird thing to say. This is what Oaks has been pushing for at least several months. The reason I say it's a weird thing to say is that gender in the proclamation is said to be essential to your identity and eternal. It's part of your pre-mortal identity, it's part of your mortal identity, and it's part of your post-mortal identity, which means that your spirit has a gender. And that's interesting, because if gender is supposed to be, biological sex at birth, then that almost seems to imply something that just seems extremely strange to me, and that is that there's like spiritual chromosomes and spiritual genitalia and so on.
Well, and also, biological sex to me sounds like it can, within the context of Mormon theology, biological sex is part of a human body. So if you have a biological sex premortally, but you don't have a body, at least a robust body, it's some type of like a spirit body or something. So yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's like inferring that there's some kind of like spirit chromosomes,
yeah,
and spirit genitalia. And what is that?
Yeah. Well, besides being... See, this isn't really necessarily a criticism of it because it's just a weird conclusion. I wouldn't say it's absurd, although it does kind of sound absurd to me. But it's problematic, too, because, as you know, biological sex isn't a fixed thing. It's something that's dynamic throughout the history of a species and throughout an individual's life. And it's not the kind of thing that they are talking about in the Proclamation on the Family, which is eternal. It's an impermanent, you know, feature of the way the world is. But it's clear that biological sex isn't like that. It's impermanent.
Well, and can we just address, too,
not impermanent.
Not impermanent, yeah. Yes, yes. The idea of, okay, so this fixed, immutable biological sex that you had premortally, mortally, and postmortally. But then it totally negates the idea of the biological variances between man and woman, right? So we have intersex conditions, which include what? Gonadal tissue, genitalia, internal reproductive anatomy, hormones. There are all sorts of things that contribute to one's biological sex assignment, even though people tend to want to focus on genitalia. And I'm just thinking, okay, so if we're going to say that biological sex is this immutable thing, so then you should be totally okay with intersex individuals who do not want to transition to a binary at all. Because if it's totally, you know, like this is your predetermined, da 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 da, then you really shouldn't be encouraging intersex people to modify their bodies. Am I right?
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, if we're talking about biological sex, I think when they say biological sex at birth, what they mean is whatever the assignment was.
Right.
And that's going to be really problematic because for intersex kids, if they're forced into an assignment, which they usually are, and not all intersex kids, obviously, those with ambiguous genitalia, then they might decide that that wasn't right. It doesn't feel right. It was the other gender that they should have been. And it seems to me that it's awful or horrible to tell them, no, the gender you were assigned is the one that you're stuck with. The way we do gender assignment at birth is problematic. And the scientists are recognizing this. And so eventually the medical establishment will. They'll recognize that the way we do gender assignment doesn't make sense. And, or at least they should. Right. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be making predictions about what will happen, but it seems to me that if we keep going in the direction that we're going, that they will become more nuanced in how they assign gender. And now the church has, you know, hung their hat on that.
Yes.
As if doctors somehow have an insight into the gender of your spirit.
Right. Exactly. Right. So it makes doctors and scientists now prophets and soothsayers about saying something about your eternal identity, which is so peculiar to bring in science into this more pastoral type document, you know. And so it's interesting to me, too, that so we're recognizing that biological sex is on a spectrum. And I would love to hear a little bit more about that from you just to help educate our listeners, because people will say, oh, gender's on a spectrum. Yeah, because we can all dress differently and sound differently. But what I think people sometimes neglect is that biology is far more on a spectrum than we like to account for either, because people want to even most educated people will be like, oh, there's three genders. There's man, woman, and intersex. When even that isn't even telling the whole story. There's a whole spectrum of like what constitutes the gradients of when a woman is a woman and when she is intersex and when an intersex person then becomes into the gradient of man. And so can you talk to me a little bit about that spectrum?
Yeah, I can, although I think you probably know at least or more than as I do. So Well, it seems to me that the way that I would put it is that biology is a multidimensional spectrum. There are various different karyotypes that are possible. And it's not just two, it's at least five, might be more, but, mm-hmm. In addition to that, there are divergences that happen all over the place later down the line after, you know, chromosomal activity. So for example, you know, we all have both testosterone and estrogen in our, you know, in our systems, but we have them to varying degrees. Usually people with XY, for example, will have a lot of testosterone. Although in some cases, although they'll have a lot of testosterone, the testosterone won't actually have an effect on the body and they end up presenting female, right?
Like androgen insensitivity syndrome.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, so
what we see is that there are many points in the process of biological sexual development where things can go in various different directions, and it's almost never binary. It's always, and in many cases, it's also a matter of degree. So the chromosomal stuff's not quite a matter of degree, but hormones is a matter of degree, and those even fluctuate over someone's life and depending on the environment. So for example, we know that women who experience trauma while they're pregnant, there's a significant hormonal difference, and that sometimes has an effect on the fetus, right?
Mm-hmm.
One interesting avenue of research in scientifically right now would be to look at whether that could have anything to do with the trans brain, or at least the gender dysphoric brain, which,
right,
you know, we have done research on. And we know that their hormones affect the brain in different degrees, and that trans people's brains line up with who they identify with, not with their birth assignment.
Yeah. I love that you brought up, it's not just your biology, but how your biology functions as well. So like for someone with androgen insensitivity syndrome, they may have the air quotes markings of a male assignment, but the way their biology is reacting and interacting with each other creates what people would look at and call a female. And that's so peculiar, because it's like, even when we talk about assigning people a gender based upon purely morphology and aesthetics and what you look like, even that isn't even, you know, telling the whole picture anymore. You have to look inside the biology to kind of see where our sex assignments, again, I'm using air quotes here for the listeners, where our sex assignments are coming from. Because even if you were to have a baby and you look at the baby and you want to give them a sex assignment based upon genitals, like, that is not even close to anything that constitutes how your biology is and how your biology might change in the future. So gender, basically, it's too queer to be binary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you know, some people who are very pro-trans will say, look, gender is just a social construction and it's separate from biology. And it is, and a lot of what they say is very important and interesting, because they point out the arbitrariness or the contingencies of the way we define gender. They show that there's a lot of arbitrariness involved in this. It doesn't have to be this way. They also show that that's connected sometimes to, you know, the power structure, the arbitrariness. It's actually not arbitrary. It's an attempt to dominate one group. But I also don't think that we should just give the biology to the essentialist, because the biology isn't essentialism. It's not essentialist. It's very dynamic. It changes significantly over time for everyone. And so the idea that gender is eternal, you know, doesn't fit very well with saying also that gender is biological sex.
Because even that fluctuates.
Yeah.
And not only that, it fluctuates naturally, but it also fluctuates by choice, right? So for So for someone like me, I've been on T blockers before for my testosterone, and my hormones levels have changed as I've continued to age and things like that. But the peculiar thing is, I get no flack from any leaders about me taking T blockers because it's in congruence with my assignment. And so as long as it's not in rejection of the assignment, I can take up the T blockers, I can change my biology, I can have surgery after surgery, which I have done, and all these things because it's like, oh, because that was the assignment and you're just reinforcing the assignment. To now, with the person sitting next to me and their biology was assigned something different, they're gonna say, oh, you wanna go on T blockers? Oh, you wanna have surgery? Nope, not okay. So why is it okay for my body and why is it not okay for the trans woman's body? And that is like the fundamental, like pivotal thing for me. And I can't get around it other than it's just the rejection of an authoritarian assignment.
Yeah. Well, I think, that's definitely, I mean, this is definitely the case. Then in the new policy, they make it clear that they are strongly in discouraging anyone from socially or medically transitioning. Interestingly, it seems like they only barely studied medically transitioning because they have that paragraph in there that says essentially this: for parents and adult individuals who are considering taking hormones to deal with thoughts of suicide, that's okay if you think about it a lot first, but then don't try to also medically transition or socially transition. Now, to say that is basically a contradiction in terms because they actually, when you take hormones, that is the first step. And for most trans folk, it's the only step in medically transitioning. It's the biggest one too. Like it has a huge effect on your body. Your body dramatically changes as a result of the hormones. And so that's already medical transition. You don't need to have the surgeries to medically transition. So they're just confused in what they wrote in the policy.
It's so true. And not only, like, I'm so glad you brought up the way hormones change you, because if it's okay to take hormones, but you're saying don't transition, whether you like it or not, hormones change you. They change the way I don't know. I'll let you speak for yourself. I'll speak for myself. But hormones and all the different variations of hormones I've been on before have changed me in very positive ways and very negative ways. Like for someone like me, I'm okay with some T blockers, but then when they give me feminizing hormones, I start getting really sick. I get delirious. It's really just not okay with my body. But for someone like my body, just finding the right dosage of hormones is in and of itself a type of transitioning to whatever it is I want to become. And so you're so right, hormones being the first thing that you do. But again, they're confused, right? Because like you say, don't transition, but you can use hormones. And it's like,
that is transitioning.
Exactly. Like how have hormones changed you personally?
So it changed me in ways that I expected, but mostly in ways that I didn't quite expect. I had read about, but I just didn't realize how much the change was going to affect me. So for example, my skin is entirely different. It's smoother, softer, but also thinner. And so, I get bruised more easily than I used to. Things hurt more when I bump into things. Getting the lid off the pickle jar is harder than it was before because your skin's thinner.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that changed that I didn't even realize would change in the way that it did. And it really had a positive effect on me.
Now I can tell that to my husband when he opens the jar for me to say, look, it's not your muscles. I have the muscles. It's the skin.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's the skin. Well, it is the muscles too, actually. Yeah. There is that effect.
Oh, come on.
The T blockers blocking testosterone does reduce your strength.
Well, and I know you've been a competitive cyclist and runner.
Yeah.
And how has that affected your performance?
So my performance dropped by about 30%. My testosterone levels are not low enough for me to legally compete in professional women's categories. I would have to get them down further. So I'd have to take more T blockers than I am taking.
Yeah.
And then I'm already slower than all of them. So you know, it wouldn't have helped me. In other words, this idea that someone who's not quite fast enough to be pro in the male category, which was me, might want to go pro by transitioning, this idea doesn't make any sense, because actually T blocker, if you get your testosterone below 10, basically, given the units that they use, if you get it below 10, your strength is going to be decreased. Usually it's at least 25%. In my case, I think it's more. Another big change that I underwent in transitioning, in taking hormones, was my emotional way of relating to the world was different. So before, with high levels of testosterone and lower levels of estrogen, a lot of my emotions that were negative would just turn into anger. So I was angry a lot. Whereas now, after, you know, taking estrogen, my emotions are clearer to me. I can distinguish between them a little bit better. They're in some cases, like sadness and heartbreak, it's more pronounced. Another thing that the change that people wouldn't realize is that your change in taste, you have a change in taste in food. So before, I used to really like beer with hops, and now I basically only like beer and no hops. Yeah. The bitter I just can't take.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile, but most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temper recommend if you want.
That's so interesting. Going back to the text, when they talk about, you know, taking hormones for this intent, and the intent is, you know, to reduce dysphoria and suicide ideation, and then to take hormones for the intent of transitioning is not okay. It just seems weird, because you're now policing the person's intent, even though the action is the same. It's just people taking hormones to make their lives better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and in the case of a trans person, the reason that they take the hormones is because they have, or some trans people do, not all trans people have this, and every reason for being trans to me is valid. But for some trans people like myself, we have gender dysphoria, which has two components. There's a social component of it, where you know you feel uncomfortable with all of the social roles associated with your gender assigned at birth. But there's also a body component, and that actually for me has always been the more difficult. I was willing to flout conventions, right? But gender conventions. But I always had this dysphoria with regard to my body. Well, actually always, especially after puberty, and the older that I, you know, as I grew older, testosterone's effects are cumulative, and so it got worse and worse and worse. And it has to do with, you know, a lot of things. It has to do in part with the way your body appears, but also the way it feels. That's a big thing. And also the way you feel emotionally. That's also a thing that I didn't realize. I was having dysphoria about having that much anger, and I was having dysphoria about my skin being too tough for me. I needed it to be softer. I was, you know, I have dysphoria about the structure, the overly muscular defined structure of my body that came from being a competitive mountain biker. You know, I mean, and all of that is now, I would say, 70% better because of hormones.
Wow. Wow. Well, and I'm glad you brought up the idea of gender dysphoria too. And what I think people don't really talk about as much is that gender dysphoria itself is on its own weird multidimensional spectrum, to where even cis people have certain amounts of gender dysphoria, to where like my body isn't doing or performing or looking the way it does to, you know, whatever the expectation is that it should be doing or looking like. And so when we talk about gender dysphoria, I think that at least for me, it would seem empowering to recognize, look, everybody has to a certain extent a little bit of gender dysphoria, or most people do. Why are we singling out trans people to be like, oh, well, your gender dysphoria isn't something you can do anything about through hormones or surgical procedures or whatever. But then like someone like me, sure, go ahead, Blair, have at it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it all goes back to the convention of how we just assign gender. And that is pretty arbitrary given the way that biological sex really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and you also think about it too. And again, I am not shaming anyone who has plastic surgery. I've had my fair share myself. But like plastic surgery is pretty high in the state of Utah. And I know tons of people who have surgical alterations to their body regularly to get their bodies looking the way they want to. And so we have a church handbook that's singling out trans people surgery, but why are you not singling out all the other surgeries that are taking place to relieve cis people of their gender experience or gender dysphoria and what they want their body to look like?
Yeah, it is problematic. They do discourage plastic surgery, at least in previous handbooks. And Boyd K. Packer gave a famous talk where it's the Temple of the Lord, is talking about the body, and he discouraged. I think in that talk he discouraged practice.
I remember actually, that. No. Yeah, I think you are right, because I remember the analogy he used about your body as a temple, and so it's a temple of the Lord. And I remember thinking that. And I also worked for a design firm for a short while, and I think, but temples get renovated all the time. We change the plumbing, we fix the foundation. Hey, guess what? When it burns down, we rebuild it and get the other structure. It's like temples are always changing.
Yeah.
The analogy didn't work on that one.
Yeah. So, I do think that there is a double standard with respect to trans folk. And I think that, you know, if people are wondering why, I think that there's at least one answer that I am persuaded by. And that's this. The LDS church leadership, the ones who are making these decisions, they have a lot of power. I don't think the average member realizes how much power they actually really, you know, have. They have a lot of institutional power, but they also ultimately control $100 billion, which gives you a lot of political power in this country. And they exercise that a lot in Utah. These people have a lot of power, and they don't want to lose it. And so allowing women into the government of the church would dilute that, right? And they only stand to lose power by doing that. So they don't want to do that. And hence the strong commitment to the gender binary. It's a means of excluding women from the decision-making procedures in the church.
So it comes down to misogyny again.
Yeah. And so then you have to keep that. I mean, they have a very strict binary in order to think of it as complementarian. Women should do some these things and men should do these things. It just so happens all the things that involve power are the ones that men do. So they have to keep that intact, and both homosexual relationships and also trans folk problematize it because they transcend those boundaries. They either set it up so that it's not complementarian anymore to gay men
right.
married together and sharing all the duties, and they mm-hmm. don't fit into gender roles, and or it's because somebody actually sort of transcends the boundary by being trans, like myself.
But. Yeah, exactly. That makes a ton of sense, because if you can have, say, a trans man, air quotes, come to the other side of the power dynamic, then what's to stop anyone from coming to the other side of the power dynamic?
Yeah.
That's super fascinating. And it does make sense, too, because if you think about just power at large, it's predicated on the idea of inequality. There is no power dynamic if there is no inequality dynamic, right? And so that clear distinction, like, oh, it's man and woman. This is the clear distinction right here. And so I'm just seeing it right now as you're saying it, that if you want to make that clear power distinction in the pie chart, oh, well, this is it. And you will do anything to defend that if you're afraid of losing that kind of power.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's super fascinating. So back to the handbook, I want to talk a little bit about socially transitioning, because one part that really stuck out to me is they say, quote, a social transition includes changing dress or grooming or changing name and pronouns to present oneself as his or her birth sex. So it says specifically name and pronouns. But then in the second or third to last paragraph, it says, if a member decides to change her or her preferred name and pronouns and address, the name preference may be noted in the preferred name field on the membership record.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, don't do this, but hey, if you do this, we'll do this.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of, again, really confusing, because it just kind of leaves it up to the discretion of the bishop to be like, you know, I'll note this in your chart, but are you going to actually call this person by their name and by their pronouns?
Yeah.
It's so weird.
It fits into patterns in church leadership. One pattern in Mormon church leadership is that the bishop has a lot of power in the ward, a lot more than anyone would in any other major religion, is any of the mainline Christian churches, the Catholic Church. The bishop has a lot more power, because like in the Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church, they have ways of, you know, controlling this bureaucratically so that people don't, it's not a matter of whim on the part of the local, you know, priest. It's governed by law. The Catholics actually have law, and the Presbyterians have rules. But in the Mormon church, the bishop does have some rules. I mean, they're the guidelines in the handbook, but bishops have a lot of power. So I think that's part of what's going on here. And I also think that they just don't understand trans folk, because I don't think they're really listening to us.
Right.
And so I think part of a strategy is to be kind of, you know, confused about it and say, well, it's nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a sense, though, that I can see a positive thing here. What they're basically saying is, okay, well, we're not going to accept your social transition, but at least we won't be so impolite as to misgender you and use the wrong name. Although it's not clear there that that means that the membership should all use the right name. It just means
right.
that we'll put it in your chart on the computer.
Right. Well, and I think that's, at least that's how I read it. When I leaned more to the idea that they are confused about what it means to, one, be trans, two, socially transition, to medically transition, and what these things actually look like and what they actually do to your body. I mean, exhibit hormones, the paragraph on hormones, it's just like, that makes no sense to say you can't transition, but then you take hormones. That is a transition, right? So I want to get any more of your thoughts that you have on this, like your reactions to this and how it affects
yeah.
you and just anything.
One of the things that I initially thought as I read the new policy, because I had been writing about it, the old one, and so I knew about all of the details, was the analogy with that gender in this case has sort of with race. In particular, you know, essentially this policy is saying that trans folk in the church are unless they deny themselves and not live authentically, they are going to be second-class members of the church, second-class citizens in the church community, which is essentially the same that was true about blacks in the church until 1978. And I think that was to a large extent about the larger white supremacy in the United States. But of course, the church stuck to it for a lot longer than they had to, if they ever had to, really. And I can't see that as being something that's acceptable, right? Having right. some people that were, you know, you're willing to take tithing from them, but at the same time,
they can't come to the temple.
They can't actually do the things that for some Mormons are the most significant part of being a Mormon. So it's, my reaction there is basically, I'm glad I left because, it's not a safe environment for people like me. I mean, living in the church as a closeted trans person, which I knew very early, in my life about that I was both queer and that I didn't know what the name was, but I knew what my desires were.
Right.
But I knew also, and I made a conscious decision to repress this about myself and to just try to live what you're supposed to do in Mormonism. And I did that, but the experience traumatized me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that that's going to end with this new policy. I think if anything, now trans folk will have a target on their back. Mm-hmm. And they'll be explicitly seen as second class citizens mm-hmm. in the church community. And I think the trauma will continue to happen, which is it's a huge issue.
Well, I'm almost inclined to want to one-up you and feel like trans folk, the queer community, is almost like a third-class citizen. And then, like, women are almost the second-class citizen. You know what I mean? Just, like, in the hierarchy, it's just... It's and I agree with you. Like, it's totally been traumatizing. And a reoccurring thing I hear from trans and queer folk is just that... I didn't have the vocabulary to describe what was happening to me, but I knew what was happening to me. I knew my desires. I knew that this was something atypical happening to my body or something of those lines. And I think sometimes we overlook the trauma that's happening to the kids because they just haven't developed the vocabulary yet to raise their hand and say, I'm hurting in this way, in this capacity, to this degree. And that's what concerns me almost more than anything. And like my maternal instincts come out and I'm like, it's about the kids. Like I was a primary president. I'm like, no, these kids, the most important thing, like when I was primary president, the most important things when they came into the primary room is to know that they were loved and safe. You're loved and safe in this room. The rest of the stuff, we'll figure all that other stuff, but you're loved and safe here. And I'm just thinking for trans kids, for queer kids, that's not the experience. And I know firsthand, you know firsthand, because that was not our experience. And I think it's policies like this that is just another contribution to, hey, let's just remind you, this isn't a safe place where you're loved unconditionally.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually an environment that encourages a certain degree of bullying of those who aren't gender conforming. So, you know, as I grew up in the church, I've always been a very feminine person, and I probably the worst bullying that I experienced in my life came from church members, both kids my age. And also actually church leaders, basketball coach, scout leader, seminary teacher. In fact, this happened to me. Early morning seminary was a place where I was, you know, essentially bullied or teased all the time. So
on account of being more feminine.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. And it's not that the church leadership really wants these people to be bullies,
yeah.
but if you set up things in this kind of way, that's what you're going to end up encouraging, right? You know, people who invalidate trans identities academically are giving cover, intellectual cover, for those who want to beat up trans people in public when they see them, or you know, when they find out that they're dating somebody who's trans.
Right. It creates like a social enforcement of, hey, you're crossing the boundary now. Step back in line into your box.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's definitely traumatic. Again, I can attest to that. I think also about the church handbook and things like that, people were making comments on social media about how it's not sustainable. And I actually agree, but I'm like really happy that it's not sustainable, because when they put out policies like this that are unsustainable models, well, that's just ripe for continuing revelation, new changes, new things coming about. And so the fact that it's not sustainable to me isn't necessarily a bad thing. To me, it's more of a good thing. In seeing the future hopes and dreams of what it would be like for trans folk, how would you see something like that going and being?
Yeah, well, it seems to me that Mormonism can get past its theology of the gender binary, mm-hmm. and heteronormativity. It doesn't have to be part of Mormon theology. They've hung their hat on it, and I think it really does have to do with keeping power. But you know, I would hope that the church would instead, maybe kind of for the first time since Joseph Smith, lean into continuing revelation and say, look, we really believe that we come to have better knowledge over time. And they could change these things. You know, they could make it so that trans folk could be accepted in the community, gays could be accepted in the community, queer people generally could be accepted. There's no really deep theological reason for any of this. I mean, if you look at the scriptural text, there's hardly anything about, you know, gender and sex, and there's a ton about the poor, and the church does a little bit with respect to the poor, but it's not like their focus.
Right.
Their focus does often just seem to be defending a certain kind of family, which is only about, that kind of family is only barely over half of, you know, the Mormon population anyway.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And it's interesting too, the way you talk about it, as far as like where we put an emphasis on our time and things like that, because that is one of like my biggest pet peeves. And one of the reasons, there's many reasons, but one reason I still don't go to church anymore is because like the conversation, the focus of our time and what we're actually talking about, it's really on these things that are feel like put downs. Like we want to play the victim as Mormons and be like, oh, we need to defend the family against so-and-so and this, da, 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 da. And it's like, the focus of our time should be like exactly what you're saying. Like, can we focus on like helping the poor, talking about what Christ talked about? Christ didn't say much about gender. He didn't say much about sexuality, and constantly was like healing the sick and breaking the rules even. And those are the types of things that I think we should be focusing on. And I love also that you said that we should focus on, or that like your first comment was the theology. Because I think if we can get people to see the theology better, the policy works itself out, right? Because like policy without theology is just kind of empty. It's just kind of there. And so if we can work towards overcoming our biases in the theology, then we can come up with something like really cool and really inclusive.
Yeah. And there are alternative ways to interpret the theology than the orthodox view. You know, you're somebody who's worked on that. You've got a book. Is it coming out?
Yeah, the book, hopefully, fingers crossed, it's supposed to be coming out this June. And that's been my whole vision, is just like, what could this look like? Because we have options. And that's one of the things I do love about theology. And what I love about your work, too, is that theology in Mormonism is weirdly democratized in the sense that we don't have professional theologians in the church. We're all about like orthopraxy and handbooks and this is how you do things. But you can believe whatever you want to believe as long as you orthopraxy the right way, right? Mm-hmm. And so weirdly, Mormon theology, I feel like, is this really cool playground where you can go out and, you know, it's kind of like fan fiction, right? You have like this base, this story. You can't break too many of the rules. Otherwise, you know, your fan fictionalists won't follow you. But you can break a little bit of the rules in recognizing, look, what if the fan fiction looked this way instead? And that's why theology to me is just...
Yeah, that's a really cool analogy. I like
it. It's just the way that... And I hope that that is received respectfully, because fan fiction stems from people who loved the story so much, were so invested in it that they wanted it to keep going. They didn't want it to end. They wanted to keep going. And so that's kind of how I feel about queer Mormon theology. Like, I've been invested in this since before I exited my mother's uterus, right? You know, and so when we talk about the story and thinking the story didn't have to exclude me, it didn't have to exclude others, it didn't have to be this way, it could have been this way. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think like a lot of the interesting work happening right now is in theology. So everybody go read Kelly's paper and definitely read more on queer theology and things coming from queer voices, because it's exactly like what you said.
There's a new handbook called The Handbook on Mormonism and Gender coming out from Rutledge, edited by Amy Hoyt and Taylor Petrie. And it has a lot of interesting articles in it, by the titles at least. I'm also in there. I have a paper in there, or a chapter in there, a rather long chapter,
awesome.
The longest thing I've written, which is about trans issues in the church. Of course, it's now outdated, and we've already sent the proofs in, so I don't know that I can make the changes to make it fit the new policy. But also, I should mention Taylor Petrie. The reason I want to mention him is because he's done some really important work in showing that Mormon theology, and even in taking very, you know, believing perspective, Mormon theology could go post-heterosexual, right? He has a new book coming out about Mormon theology of sex and gender, which I'm really excited to read.
Oh, I'm so excited to read it too. He's going to be at Sunstone doing a discussion. I'm on the discussion panel with him, and I am so excited to read this book. And Taylor's done his homework too, right?
Yeah.
Like, I really like Taylor Petrie's
He has responded to the new handbook, and he makes a really good point, which he also has made in past publications, and that's this: if this stuff is all so natural, if gender is just a natural part of who you are, like an eternal part of who you are, it doesn't need to be enforced at all.
Exactly. Why do you have a handbook on it?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, exactly. I think this is a brilliant point to point. I mean, it's similar to a point that John Stuart Mill made about truth. He said, look, you know, if it's really the truth, it can survive discussion. We don't need to. It's a point I ended up mentioning the wrong point from Mill. It's a point that Mill makes in his Subjection of Women, that essay where he says, look, if this is really natural, that, you know, if it's really natural that women can't, you know, be university professors or lawyers or politicians, then you don't have to enforce it. So get rid of the laws.
Yeah.
And it's the same point that Petrie's making. I think it's a really good point. I do disagree with him on one point, on one thing though. He goes a little bit further with this insight and draws the conclusion that actually gender is the social role only, which is a very trans-friendly position, because it allows, you know, I play the social role of being a woman, and so I am a woman according to that kind of view. But I think the main problem that I have with that view is that it doesn't account for body dysphoria. And I think what body dysphoria shows us about the deep philosophical or metaphysical nature of gender is that although gender is definitely a social construction, there's no question about it, how we understand it and what we do with it is a social construction, it's nevertheless one that is tethered to biology. If you think about it, actually, if you're going to construct something socially in order to have domination of one group over the other, then you need the other group to accept that social construction, which means it's going to have to kind of fit them naturally, sort of. You know, they're going to have to kind of see some of it as being true. So I think that that's actually the case. I think in thinking of gender as something that's socially constructed and like a free-floating social construction that's not really tied to any biology at all, like Judith Butler seems to say, I think that that would be wrong. I actually think we do need to talk also about the biology. I think gender is something that emerges socially and conventionally out of, you know, inclinations that we have that are a result of our biology.
So that reminds me so much of Julia Serrano's work. We read this in that class. It's kind of like a hybrid model. It's not the gender essentialist model, but it's not the purely social constructivist model. It's kind of a hybrid of the two, that both are playing a significant role in this.
Yeah. According to her, Julia Serrano, in her book, Whipping Girl.
Yes.
Which is... I highly recommend. Serrano is a biologist, publishes in biology, but is a social activist and poet as well. Mm-hmm. And she argues that we have biological inclinations that contribute to what our sense of gender is, and that these are, you know, a result of the biological features of our body, including hormones, but they're not, they don't determine gender in any kind of definite way. It just gives us inclinations that we then socially say, well, this, you know, there's men and women. Or if we're Navajo, we say that there's five genders.
Yeah.
Or a lot of societies have at least three.
Yeah. Super fascinating. And part of me really wants to get Taylor Petrie on the podcast now and sit and duke it out to tease out all the nuances of social constructivism and bioessentialism.
Yeah. It's an example of where Mormon theology can go.
Yeah.
And I find it positive in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us all about gender and educating us on this topic. Is there any final comments, anything you'd like to leave us, or anything you'd like to tell the average Mormon about, hey, this is what you can do to help trans people during this time of transition with the handbook?
I would just say, listen to trans people. We just need to be listened to.
Amen, sister. Amen. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This has been another episode of the Sunstone Fireside Podcast.